Hi, listeners. Welcome to this encore presentation of Episode 70, Heartbreak and Hostages, the Gen X made-for-TV movie, where we talk about this special art form that was low on budget and high on love triangles, deadly diseases, killer bees, lots of hostages. It's actually, you guys, the first of a double episode because we follow this episode up with 71, which was a countdown of the top 10 X made-for-TV movies.
That's right.
Oh, boy, you guys. And I was revisiting those episodes, and I was really struck, oh, my gosh, by how traumatic so many of them were.
It's horrible.
Yes, like it's we said, horrible. Killer bees, nuclear war, incest, kidnapping. Our TV watching, you guys, when we were growing up, was filled with trauma. Even our TV shows could leave us shaken to the core.
Uh-huh.
We actually devoted an entire episode to solely for the purpose of the traumas on Little House on the Prairie.
Just that one show just was so traumatic. Thanks to Michael Landon and his twisted brain.
Twisted brain and just, it was the norm. That's what I've realized.
What's so interesting about that is that so many people, I know the three of us are part of this group, we find so much comfort in Little House on the Prairie. That's our comfort show. A lot that had such a huge resurgence in popularity and viewing during COVID. It's a comfort show, which is kind of ironic because probably a solid 50, 60% of those episodes are very traumatic.
Yes. So, like, to the point where I would be afraid of my favorite show. And I'm sure the same is for you guys. There was not a single time where my mom came in and was like, oh, I don't know if you should be watching this show when they're going to shoot her horse. Like, no, Kristen, let's turn the TV off because they're going to shoot her favorite horse.
Also, there's a big snowstorm in the forecast, Kristen. And you know what? I don't know if you should be watching them walk over dead people who died in the blizzard.
Your dead neighbor. Just walk over him because we got to get back to the schoolhouse.
They just kind of glance down and they're like, well, he's dead.
Yep. Right. He died. Yeah.
I wonder how traumatic it was for the actors to be acting in these traumatic scenes. Like, did it seem
they're
like
children?
Just right,
they're children.
Exactly. Act like you're walking over dead Mr. Whoever. Yeah. But you got to get back to you got to find your way home.
One scene in particular that I always name my most traumatic scenes to be X, and then recently I was like, no, it's X. And so I said to Liam, my 22-year-old son, I'm like, I'm going to describe a scene for you, and you tell me what this is. So there is a fire, and the fire starts, and the house is going to burn down. And oh no, a baby has been left in the house. Oh no, what are we going to do? So the nanny is running back into the house, and she picks up the baby, but she can't get out because of the fire. And so then she takes her elbow, and she's crashing the window. She's going to break the window, and there are flames leaping out. And I said, what do you think that's from? And he's like, that sounds like a horror movie. I said, no, Little House on the Prairie. But that image of Mrs. Garvey with her elbow crashing the window, holding the baby with the flames leaping.
Right. And then the trauma that the parents of that child are blind.
Oh,
so they
God.
Can't see it. The only person that's really witnessing this is Hester Sue, right?
Yes.
Because all the other people are blind. So they only hear God, the Karen. Cries, which probably amplify the cries.
Yes.
They can hear the crackling. They can smell the smoke.
Oh, yeah.
And Hester Sue is alone in witnessing this. Let's just pour on the gasoline, no pun intended,
Yeah, and then let's make sure we zoom in. Zoom in on the face of Mrs. Garvey holding the baby.
Do not play with matches, kids. Is that the message we were supposed to
Or kerosene lamps.
Or a pipe.
Yeah,
or a pipe.
Yes,
it was his pipe.
Oh, it was in the basement.
Oh, Albert.
Albert.
Oh, God. Oh.
No wonder you got involved with some drugs later on.
Right. No wonder you were a meth addict. Oh, my God.
We had to ask our friend Melissa Gilbert, who also, by the way, we can't forget Little House celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Mm-hmm. And so when we were thinking about all these traumatic episodes, we had to send our friend Melissa a message and ask her, were there any of these episodes that traumatized you? Was there anything that left a mark or kept you up at night? And she came back. I just love, she was just so direct. She says, Sylvia, hands down.
Oh.
You guys, we don't even talk about Sylvia in any of our Little House episodes because it's too, it's
Google
too
it.
Much.
Just
it's
Google
too
it.
Traumatic.
We can't say it out loud.
I mean, yeah. And then she said it was followed by Albert on morphine, which I don't think any of us can forget Albert on morphine, basically foaming at the mouth. And
it's the trauma from starting the fire that killed Mrs. Garvey and the baby. Yeah.
He's had to live with that.
He became a morphine addict.
Gosh, poor Albert. Well, yeah. So just think of those are just a couple of the traumatic things just from Little House. Again, we devoted an entire episode. But at the same time, you guys, this wasn't like out of the ordinary that we were exposed to these traumatic things, whether we were supposed to be learning something through the message that we were getting, or they just wanted to scare us shitless. I don't know. Like, don't leave the house. Your parents aren't home and there are people in vans outside and all of this. So recently I was on, I think I'm using the right lingo here. I was scrolling through a Gen X subreddit. I think it was a subreddit.
Yeah, I think you're doing it.
That's what
these
things are called. On Reddit. And the original poster had asked, what were some things that scared Gen X the most? And oh my gosh, you guys, the replies. I mean, no wonder we're treating anxiety now. Like, this is where it started. Okay. I just want to read you a couple of the things that people said. The responses go on and on and on. But one of the things that's, I guess it's kind of comforting, is that we were all scared of the same stuff. I mean, like, it didn't matter. One guy's like, I lived in West Virginia and we were scared of this. And then someone's like, I lived in New Mexico. We were scared of the same thing. And so, you know, there's the obvious, like the Pop Rocks and Coke. There were those kind of urban legend things.
Right.
But in terms of, you know, quicksand, we got that idea from television, okay?
Mm-hmm. From Scooby-Doo.
The kidnapping, like chloroform in a cloth being put up to your face. I mean, that was TV. The white van was TV. And so some of these are so funny. I just have to read some of them. They're not all TV based, but they are like, you guys. And some of them I had forgotten about, like the poisoned Tylenol. We talked about the killer bees, the Bermuda Triangle. We said kidnapping, a shark attack, like, you know, were people really afraid that much of sharks before Jaws, right?
I'm sure I say this in our Blockbusters episode, but I couldn't go swimming in a lake after Jaws.
Oh, there are
and actually, I didn't even see Jaws. It was just the commercials.
Well, yeah, but all of a sudden, like pre-Jaws, my mom never talks about when she went to the beach as a kid being scared of sharks, but that was like a given for us. This one I vaguely remember, but so many people mentioned it, and it was satanic panic. Do you guys remember when everyone was like afraid of the devil and the music backwards and what it was saying and all? Scary. I think we've talked about toxic shock syndrome. Acid rain.
Yeah, but someone did just die of that. Recently? Did you guys just see that?
Yeah, I saw that.
Like,
it was
like a
People magazine. She wore her tampon for like 12 hours.
Eight hours. It said 8 hours, and my thought...
I did lots of that all the time. Yeah, well, at a wedding. I love what it said at a wedding.
It did say at a wedding. I think this was like a Gen X scare. They're like, oh, we want to get more Gen X readers. They're going to click on.
They're going to know.
The fact that Michelle and I both clicked on the toxic shock syndrome story.
It
stayed with us, okay? Mm-hmm. What about driving at night with, like, the interior car light on? Or, like, did you guys remember, like, if someone was flashing their lights behind you?
It was a gang signal.
The guy was standing, you know, he kept, like, coming up from your back seat to stab you.
Oh, wait. Oh, that's not what I thought you were going to say.
Oh, there was that one.
Oh, my God. That's right. Somebody in your back seat. That's right.
I mean, can you? It was just like...
I was thinking of when you flash the headlights.
Oh,
like
that
somebody
people
was driving without their headlights on. Then, you know, to be kind, you flash your headlights at them to say, hey, your headlights aren't on, but it could be a prank. And the next, and it was like a gang initiation that if somebody flashed their lights at you, well, then you got to kill them.
Well, that was a ghost story, though, that we told at slumber parties. And I don't remember it, but it was like, and the guy was flashing his lights behind you. And then when you finally pull over, he's like, because every time I flashed my lights, the person in the back seat was raising his arm up with a blade, a knife to kill you. And everybody would go,
right. Well, I believed that. You know, I mean, like, I always believe those stories. And
I still look in my back seat all the time.
Well, yeah, that's what people said on here.
I definitely look in my back seat.
Why? It's comforting. It's scary that we all, like, this obviously over 50 years later, we are still impacted by these things. And it's so interesting to read that we all have the same ones, you know?
Yeah. What about the razor blades in your Halloween candy.
Oh, yeah.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
Or your apple. And then another one we were all scared about that's been debunked is if you go swimming, like 30 minutes, but within 30 minutes after you eat, you're going to get a cramp and drown.
Or if you swallow your gum.
Yeah.
You know,
Sticks to your lungs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How does it get in your lungs? I remember my mom saying that. Kristen, how does the gum get to your lungs?
Or the watermelon seed. And you grow like a watermelon.
But you guys, I would swallow gum and sometimes accidentally, but I would just imagine that in my belly, it was making like a gum ball, like a gum wall. And then I'd be like terrified that it was going to be like this giant wad. Of gum.
Right? I mean, I think we were all. And then there were those kind of like urban legend things. But then there was the real stuff that we learned like in school, you know, all the fire stuff. I mean, I guess fire safety is important. But man, that scared the bejesus out of me. And like, you know, the stop, drop and roll and who was going to be the monitor. Like you have to have those like drills in your house. And who was going to have the ladder?
That's right.
That went down that rolly ladder.
And you had the sticker on your window saying, I'm here, firefighters, come save me. There's a child in this room. I'm going to die in a fire unless you come get me first.
Well, can we come full circle to our Little House on the Prairie episode?
Yes.
Fire. If only there had been
so many fires.
If they had a sticker on the window.
Oh my gosh. But it was so... it was so fun to read these because some I had forgotten about and immediately went, oh my gosh, yes, like some of those car ones. Or like walking up to your car and there was someone underneath that would slash your Achilles heels with the knife and you'd fall over.
Okay, but still, for real, you guys, that can happen. I'm scared of don't debunk that. That can happen.
I'm still scared of all of this stuff.
It's not debunking it, but that's...
Yes.
Why our generation is the way we are. We can be on... our radar has to be looking out for so many things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and don't forget probably the biggest anxiety inducing thing of our Gen X era is the game Perfection.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Right?
They just harp on
there's nothing that puts you on edge like Perfection or Super. I had Super Perfection. So I had to like piece all the little pieces together, like little Tetris pieces. I was like, I don't know. I don't remember which one.
It was Big Pharma back then. They were like planting the seeds. Let's create an entire generation of freaked out, scared, anxious people. And then when they're adults, they'll want to take drugs for this.
In 50 years, we're going to be rich.
That's right. We're going to come up with these things called benzos.
Yes.
And so, you guys, today is episode 200.
Oh,
I think we all need to pause.
I was like waiting for the confetti to go.
I know there's a balloon drop coming.
It's our bicentennial episode. It's like 1976.
Oh my God, it's 1976, right? It's our personal 1976.
And let's go back to Kristen remembering she thought we were only going to do six originally.
Yeah, I thought it was just going to be a limited series like on Netflix, like six
194
episodes.
Later. You guys, honestly, I know this sounds really cliche, but it's just gone by in a blur because we have so much fun, right? It really has. Because you guys, hold on for just a second. I'm glad you're sitting down because at the end of this week, we'll be celebrating 4 years. Of the Pop Culture Preservation Society. Our first episode is coming at the end of this week. So listeners, if you're listening today, watch social media at the end of this week, because I think we should just have a party. I think we should go Instagram Live with just a party.
Okay.
Oh my gosh.
Dance party?
My jaw is on the floor.
I really did not see this coming. I did not see 4 years.
I didn't forecast anything.
I had no like dreams of what this would become. I just thought I was going to show up and have some fun.
And have
you? And it's still here. Yes. I've never not had fun. I've never not sat in this chair and not had fun. How many double negatives is that?
I don't care.
It doesn't matter.
I don't care.
Well, because that's the reason we're still going. We're still trucking. And that is the reason for the success of what we've done is because we always have fun. We enjoy it thoroughly. We are so fulfilled, listeners, by your messages and your DMs, your words of support and encouragement, your support by listening, your support on Patreon and on our PayPal. It's just become this great big ball of wonderfulness, right?
A great
and fulfillment
ball of
for
wonderfulness.
Sure. It's a great big ball of wonderfulness. Yeah, we love all of you. So yeah, so happy episode 200. Happy 4 years to the Pop Culture Preservation Society. I think you guys should listen to this episode, episode 71, and I don't know, another 198.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It helps our download numbers.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
If you want us around for a fifth year.
Yeah. That's right. So please enjoy this encore presentation of episode 70, Heartbreaks and Hostages, the Gen X made for TV movie.
Just a warning to our listeners today, TV movies of the 70s and 80s are rife with salacious and traumatizing topics. From incest and rape to psychopathic killers hiding in your barn, we don't mean to make fun, but sometimes it's so outrageous you just have to laugh. So if you're triggered by any of these topics or people making light of them, you may want to skip today's episode and join us again next week. Thank you.
And they go and they get like the straight razor out of the medicine cabinet. And then they're like almost like little dwarfs. They're like holding it on their shoulders like they're going to, you know, march into the shower to kill her. And they're like, should we do it now? And
it's like the borrowers.
Maybe it is. Yeah. It's like the borrowers gone mad wanting to murder people.
Hello world, there's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the big wheel generation who walked home from school or rode the bus because there was no such thing as getting picked up at school, unless you were going to the dentist.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we will be saving the made-for-TV movie in a special two-part episode devoted to this very special art form that was low on budget, but high on love triangles, deadly diseases, killer bees, and lots of hostages.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists.
A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing.
In the early 1960s, television networks began showing what were called made-for-TV movies to encourage audiences to stay home with their TVs. Oh, shut up. Okay, I'm going to do that again. I was like standing on the wrong foot or something.
Back it up.
Okay.
You got great hair today, though.
Thank you. It's untamed in any way, shape, or form. And
you probably
dried.
Didn't even spray a ton of like volumizer in it, did you?
No.
Yeah.
No, it's just like, I don't usually blow dry my hair, so that's why it's a little puffier than normal. But, you know, this is, my mom used to say I looked like the wild woman of Borneo.
I love it.
So this is my Borneo hair.
That's better than something the cat drug in. That's what my mom used to say.
Okay, here we go. In the early 1960s, television networks began showing what were called made-for-TV movies to encourage audiences to stay home with their TVs on instead of going to the theater and turning their TVs off. They had already been rebroadcasting theatrical releases with a lot of success. And when a shortage of movie studio product slowed down their stream of rebroadcasts, networks were forced to make their own feature films, made specifically for the small screen, and the made-for-TV movie was born. So these TV movies were often made quickly, without a lot of money, because there isn't much money to be made from a made-for-TV movie, beyond getting people to stay home and keep their eyeballs on your station, whereas a theatrical film can make money from ticket sales or rebroadcasts on TV. Most television films lacked those revenue streams, and the films are seldom rerun, so they had to be made cheaply. Because if your family is sitting down in the living room watching Replacing Dad, that's a movie I came across this week, Replacing Dad, that would translate to multiple ticket sales for a theatrical release. But it only gets counted as one household in the world of TV. So big budgets were out of the question.
Yeah, there was also an economical way to produce a pilot for a show. You could test the waters with a TV movie, and even if the show didn't get picked up, you could still air the movie, and you had 2 hours of airtime for your show. So I was really amazed to find out some of my favorite shows during the 70s had actually been piloted as TV movies. Mm-hmm. We have Little House on the Prairie, and you might remember.
That was a movie?
Yeah,
Karen. Oh my remember God, you're right. The opening was the pilot was a movie, and that's Karen Grassley's favorite episode, even though it's not technically an episode,
quote unquote,
right?
Episode. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When they're moving to Walnut Grove. Right.
And we know it's Karen Grassley's favorite. Why? Because she told us.
I thought it was like there was a naked man in it or something.
No, because she told us herself it was her favorite because we talked to her.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Well, so, and then my other favorite family drama that competes with the Ingalls would be The Waltons. And that was also TV movie was called The Homecoming. And that starred Patricia Neal. So sometimes the pilots had the original, the cast members that would then go on and create those characters in the actual TV shows. Sometimes there'd be a little change up. And in that case, Patricia Neal was the mother in Homecoming, but then Michael Learned became the mother in The Waltons.
Right.
And so coincidentally, The Homecoming is the show that Karen Grassley watched to prepare for her audition for Little House on the Prairie.
Mind blown. And how do we know that? Because she told us. I'm still chuckling inside at Kristen going, I don't know, because there was a naked man in it.
On network TV in the 1970s. So they just had naked men running around.
Well, there was the guy that bathed in the creek, Gil Gerard. So that's, naked
that's right.
For
1970s.
Well,
that's true,
naked.
1970s.
Yeah. She did have eyes for him. Ma did have eyes for
him. You guys ready for a few more? We had $6 Million Man was one, as was The Bionic Woman.
Oh, yeah,
they
that's
were both.
Right.
Police Woman was one. Charlie's Angels was one.
Wow.
Basically, I want to say drama, hour-long drama series that you that we watched in the 70s and probably early 80s started as a pilot, which was very clever, in my opinion, because they only had to film one, this two-hour movie. Because now, sometimes for some of these sitcoms especially, they'll do the pilot and then they'll do like four or five episodes in case the pilot gets picked up. And that's costly, I would think.
Sure.
And
yeah.
So then sometimes they never see the light of day. So this was a really economical way to get a feel for how the show might play with people. Do you guys have any that you know of or think of?
Yeah, I was thinking from a previous episode that we did. Wasn't the Love Boat one?
Yes.
I believe.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I think Carolyn, you might have even mentioned. I don't know. Maybe it was me.
No, the Love Boat. I think it maybe even had two before it actually became a regular
TV
series.
Movies.
And then lots of times we would have, after a series was over, or even when it was actually playing and current, they would actually do a movie. So you would still get a two-hour Love Boat movie another night of the week. Or we have our favorite reunion specials of a lot of TV shows that became two-hour movies. Some of the Brady Bunch ones did, Love Boat did, Eight is Enough did, Little House on the Prairie. They all go on to kind of another way to kind of capture that audience that loved them so much.
That was the best. Yeah, and when I was doing my research for this episode, I learned that James at 15 was the movie.
Is it a feeling in the heart or is it something?
Didn't he turn 16?
after he had sex, he lost
his virginity.
Yeah. Is that what happened?
It started as James at 15 for, I don't know, maybe the first season or something. Because I'll never forget, I have a whole memory of this when my mom actually let me watch it. She had to talk to me about what the James at 16 episode was going to be about. And I got to watch it in her bedroom on a little black and white TV. And then the way the credits and the beginning of the show were, it showed the same James at 15, the same kind of thing it had always shown. And then it crossed out the 15.
That's right.
15, and it wrote 16.
And they put 16
in the corner.
God, I believe that whole show only on for 17 episodes or something too? Like
it was a hot
like a
minute.
Season and a
and
half
I was
or
there
something.
For yeah. everyone.
I was too. It seems like a big part of my adolescence.
Yeah. Well, he was over Tiger Beat during that time.
He was Lance Kerwin.
Oh yeah, he's in one of my favorite TV movies we'll talk about later.
Okay. So what this means, because we can't stop talking about James at 15 in our made for TV movie episode, what this means is that we have to do an episode on James at 15.
Okay.
So stay tuned.
I'm in.
Okay, so as we said, TV movies generally didn't have big budgets, but even though big budgets were out of the question, there were still some made-for-TV movies that were considered really good, even though they were low-budget affairs. The TV movie that is often cited as the best of all time, not just the Gen X era, but of all time, of all the TV movies, is a movie called Duel. And this was mentioned by a lot of our followers when we asked them for their favorite TV movies. And this is about a businessman commuting to work who's terrorized and harassed by a big rig-style tractor-trailer truck for 2 hours in prime time. And it was the directorial debut of a fresh young upstart named Steven Spielberg.
Really?
Yes. Yes, and he used this movie, Duel, as his audition tape, essentially, for the job of directing Jaws. It's the same movie. It's the same movie. And even Steven Spielberg says there's a real connection between Duel and Jaws because it's about a Leviathan versus the everyman. Uh-huh. I mean, that's all that Jaws is. And if you watch them side by side, you'll see he draws the tension exactly the same way.
Wow.
I never Monster, everyman. That.
Mm-hmm. It makes total sense. Have both of you seen Duel?
No.
No, I've never seen it.
Oh, I've seen it several times. It's good. And when you just read the, you know, tagline or whatever, the description of the movie, it doesn't sound like you could be absorbed for 2 hours, especially when one of the main characters isn't even a human, really. It's the
it's a truck.
Right. But oh my gosh, it is the most evil truck. And you literally, you're on the edge of your seat. I know it sounds ridiculous, but Steven Spielberg pulled it off. And yeah, I could now totally see the Jaws connection. But it's, you need to watch it. And I think your husbands would enjoy it too.
Okay, that's
I feel
a
like
really good
this
retro
whole
find.
Episode is like sponsored by The More You Know. Because I know. You know, with a little shooting rainbow, because I'm gonna learn so much, and I'm gonna at the end of this episode have the longest list of movies I need to go find and watch.
I know. It's true. Oh, yeah.
Starting with Duel.
Mm-hmm. I promise you both will enjoy it.
So Duel was made for about $450,000. And with, you know, in the hands of the right director, he was able to make that into a historic release, a historic piece of film. Film? Is it still film if it's on TV? Whatever.
Sure.
Okay. So how do you cheap out on a TV movie production? You know, Steven Spielberg did it by just having a truck and a car as characters, essentially. But what you can do is you have a small crew. You have limited cast members and sets. Maybe you have an underdeveloped script. But you can also use musical montages full of cut footage, flashback sequences, or you can repeat footage. They did that all the time. They would use the same footage they used in the beginning of the film. And they would have extended periods of dramatic slow motion footage. All of this takes up time that you don't have to pay for. And there are certainly no special effects. And also, you might hire a young upstart director with no experience named Steven Spielberg, who is probably like, you know, I get $15 an hour. Oftentimes, these made-for-TV movies could just feel like drawn-out episodes of a primetime drama series. Unless, of course, you juice things up with a train wreck of a topic, something so outrageous that people can't look away.
Like Edith Bunker and a love triangle in the 1981 classic Isabel's Choice. She's torn between the man who loves her and the man who needs her. It's the toughest choice a woman can make, and she's loving every minute of it. Edith, you naughty minx.
Oh my gosh, Michelle, you need to read all of these little taglines.
Let's not forget, like, you guys, this isn't young Gene Stapleton. This is 1981.
Edith.
This is Edith Bunker, Gene Stapleton.
Oh, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, big time Edith. Yep. She's been around a while by 1981.
You go. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whoa. Or the drama Sweet Hostage, starring Linda Blair. It's about an escaped psychopath and the illiterate farm girl he drags to a deserted cabin to become her teacher, friend, and lover. Yikes. Oh, I don't think I was allowed to watch that.
Here's Carolyn's worst nightmare. Or Trapped, a 1973 movie starring James Brolin as a man mugged in a department store who awakens to find he's been locked in overnight. And then is attacked by security dogs.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Seriously. That is Carolyn. If you guys listen to
Carolyn's
our
worst nightmare
episode, that's Carolyn's worst nightmare.
It is. But when I read that in my research, that description, I thought, How on earth do you make that a 2-hour movie?
I know.
He's trapped and he gets attacked by dogs. I mean, gosh. And I guess that was low budget too, if it's just James Brolin and some dogs.
One guy. I mean, the dogs are probably cheap.
Cheap, right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all they have to do is just run at the camera baring their teeth, probably. And they just use that footage over and over and over again.
You don't even have to retape it.
Dogs running. No.
Yeah.
No.
You just use the same footage.
Snarling dogs.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
So often TV movies were also made to cash in on salacious stories in the news, like Casualties of Love, the Long Island Lolita story, starring Alyssa Milano as Amy Fisher, the teenager who shot Joey Buttafuoco's wife in the face on her own doorstep. A movie that, I love this so much, a movie that one reviewer said feels not unlike a very special episode of Beverly Hills 90210.
I remember that one. I remember that movie.
Too.
That was like when we were adults, though, that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was
but
like
I was all
90s.
In to watch that movie, yeah.
Yeah, man. This is where we get a lot of the true crime style movies, like Small Sacrifices, which is about a woman on trial for the attempted murder of her own children, or The Burning Bed, which we will talk about in a little bit. Both of these, by the way, starring Farrah Fawcett.
Tonight.
I, Francine, take thee, Mickey, to be my husband. To have and to hold, for richer or poorer.
Farrah Fawcett in a powerful drama torn from today's headlines, based on a true story of a woman trapped in a brutal and violent marriage until the night she struck back.
There is no doubt that some of these movies were memorable. No matter what you say about good or bad or high quality or B movie, we remember them.
Yeah, I remember some of them. My most memorable actually made our countdown, so I'm going to hold off on those. But do you guys remember the 1983 movie called Thursday's Child? Is that ringing any bells with you?
I don't remember this one.
Okay, Thursday's Child. Here's who it starred. It starred, I'm going to save the best for last. It starred Gina Rowlands, Tracy Gold, Jessica Walters, you know, Lucille Bluth, Jessica Walters, and it starred Rob Lowe. And you guys, I feel like this might be the movie where Rob Lowe first came on my radar. It's the one, he plays Sam, who's a football player, who discovers he has a heart condition and needs a heart transplant. And that's kind of the whole story. That's the nutshell. You know, we talked, and those of you listening, we did a whole episode on after school specials, and then we did a separate episode. The whole episode is about the blockbuster 1980 Rob Lowe vehicle, Schoolboy Father, which was his first appearance on TV. So he had done Schoolboy Father in 1980, but Thursday's Child was to be Rob Lowe's first film role. And it was slated for 1982, but it actually got bumped to 1983. So it came out the same year The Outsiders came out. Thursday's Child actually was really well received. It was nominated for 2 Golden Globes, and Rob Lowe his first appearance on film, Rob Lowe was nominated in the category of best performance by an actor in a supporting role in a series, miniseries, or motion picture made for TV. Yeah.
Oh, my God. And how old would he have been then? Like 16? He's really young.
Gosh. I would have to look that up.
But
yeah,
a teenager,
like a late teenager,
right?
Yeah. And then Gina Rowlands in the movie, she plays his mom. She was nominated for Best Performance by an Actress. And, God, you guys, I love Gina Rowlands. And Hope Floats, my God, with all her taxidermied animals, she's a treasure. So that one has stuck with me as one that when I see Thursday's Child or something, and I don't know if it was the story. You know, it's one of those tragic. There's a lot of those where the young athlete or the young kid gets sick or whatever.
Oh,
yeah.
Guys.
And he has to have, you know, he's trying not to cough and he's trying to act like he's okay because he doesn't want to worry his parents and he ends up having to have a heart transplant.
It was a tearjerker.
Yeah.
It was a 1980s tearjerker.
But it's memorable for me. Like, that's one that is.
That was probably a coming of age moment for you.
Maybe. I mean, well, surely because I was like, well, hello, Rob Lowe. So I guess we can define coming of age differently, but sure.
Right.
Let's say, yeah. I have a lot
that I remember, but there is one very distinct memory about a movie called Leave Yesterday Behind, starring John Ritter as a young veterinary student who is paralyzed while he's playing polo. And Carrie Fisher as his horse trainer slash love interest, who's trying to help him rehab him from his disability. And there were some, I, I, it's not the big moments that I remember. It's small moments that I remember. For instance, when Carrie Fisher puts him in the pool and is trying to teach him to swim, and John Ritter's in the pool and he can't use his legs. And I'm like, John Ritter, be careful. He doesn't
kind of throw him in there, but she's trying to show him he can do it. So
yes,
she's
and he's
like,
scared.
Yes.
And it was terrifying.
Yes, I agree. I remember. Oh. This is more whiplash. This episode, I'm going to go to the chiropractor. It has just been crazy. I totally remember it was so frightening
watching him thinking he's drowning and he can't. That's acting, people. Don't use your legs, John Ritter. And it was really terrifying for me. But the worst part of, or maybe is the worst, the most memorable, I don't know. The worst part is this very melodramatic moment where John Ritter and his horse trainer slash love interest, he's confessing to her because now they're in love. And he's like, I don't know if I can make love. And I am mortified because I'm watching this with my grandma. I'm like, oh God. Oh, I mean, she was probably just like knitting an Afghan anyway and probably didn't even hear it. But the mortification of the moment was enough to make me remember it to this day.
Oh my gosh.
I have a question.
I remember that now.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. I wonder if you guys can answer. So Kristen, you said earlier that it was, one of the draws of these movies is that they could make them for less money. They didn't have to have the big budget. Mm-hmm. But it really seems like they had really good stars in all of
they
these movies.
Did.
I mean, in the one you just said, I mean, this is John. What year was the one you just?
This was 1979. Is it 78?
Okay, so we're post.
Maybe it's 78 or 79.
So
it's Three's Company.
He's big time.
He is.
Well,
I know
Fisher,
his name is John Ritter. Yeah.
Well, right. And Carrie Fisher, mm-hmm. I mean, Star Wars was 78. So Carrie Fisher is huge.
77. But still.
77, yes. Right.
Yeah.
And
I just know the Star Wars people would get super pissed if I let that go.
Like Brian.
And in all of these other ones we're about to talk about, I mean, they're blockbuster casts. They're all either current or very recent, mm-hmm. like TV stars, or they're in movies. So I guess that's my question then. You know, instead of hiring a lot of unknowns, they're actually still hiring.
I wonder if they didn't. Like, where does the budget go? We only have $450,000. Let's reserve $200,000 of it for Carrie Fisher and John Ritter. And then we'll use a bunch of recycled footage, right?
Well,
because then
also,
they can get our eyes.
Yeah. And you have to think, too, that for the stars, I mean, this is good business for them as well, because then mm-hmm. they're also, you know, John Ritter's able now to be a paralyzed former polo player instead of Jack Tripper. So it's good for them, too, to show their diversity as actors and all this stuff. So maybe they didn't demand the high salaries that we're used to hearing stars currently do.
Because it's good for
to
them.
Do remember, extra projects.
Do you remember how Karen Grassley said in her book that she was trying to do a made-for-TV movie? Was this when she wanted to do Battered, or maybe it was a different one? I can't remember. And Michael Landon would not let her
off the set
to make this made-for-TV movie. And just like you said, Michelle, it was an important thing for her because it was a personal topic, but because it would get her out of the prairie skirts.
Exactly.
And she needed people to see her out of prairie skirts, and Michael Landon said no.
Right. I think that's totally what it is. It was an opportunity for a lot of these stars to show their acting chops out of this character that we've become, you know, we have come to know them by. And they were probably willing to do it for less. It was a win-win. And then the movie could be marketed as, you know, Star Wars, Carrie Fisher and Three's Company.
Oh,
companies.
Yeah. And it was just
to increase their
visibility it was smart for them too.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn, did you have any titles you want to drop in here?
That I wanted to chat about was, it's called Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. 1973, but I watched it later, and I remember my mom telling me she had watched it in 1973, and she said, it's so scary. I don't think you should watch it. I can't even watch it again. It's that scary. And I was like, oh, of course I can watch it. Okay, so it stars Kim Darby, Jim Hutton, who is Timothy Hutton's dad, and you would totally recognize him if you saw the saw this movie or any of his other movies. I don't recognize any of the other names in it, so I'm not going to say them. Oh, except for William Demarest, who I think, isn't that Fred?
That's Fred.
Yeah,
Fred and Ethel.
Yeah, so Fred is in it, and maybe that was the big name that drew everybody.
Wait, who's James Frawley?
That's Fred. No, Fred is William Frawley. Isn't it William Frawley?
William Demarest is my three sons. My three
Uncle
sons.
Charlie.
Yes. Sorry.
Oh. It's the same person.
But can't you get those two mixed up? Yes. Thank you very much, Kristen. Okay. So yes. So Uncle Charlie is in it. Oh, and that's a little odd. You're not used to seeing him in this movie, which is about a young couple who inherits this strange home that is occupied by these small goblin-like creatures. They're like humans.
You should see our faces right now.
Yeah, we're like goblin-y looking, and they talk with these really weird little voices.
Oh, God.
And they want to murder Kim Darby, and no one believes her that they're in there. And the scary scene, she's in the shower, and they climb up, and they turn the lights off. They climb out of the wall.
Do they look like humans?
Yes, but goblin-y like humans.
Okay. Yes, this is so horrible. You know me.
It's horrible. And they go and they get like the straight razor out of the medicine cabinet. And then they're like almost like little dwarfs. They're like holding it on their shoulders like they're going to, you know, march into the shower to kill her. And they're like, should we do it now? And
it's like the Borrowers.
Maybe it is. Yeah. It's like the Borrowers gone mad wanting to murder people. And no one believes Kim Darby that this is happening. And they think she's going crazy. And they're gaslighting her everywhere. And they're so creepy. And they come out the fireplace. And there's a bunch of them. And they're just...
Your voice is so funny right now.
Well, watch the movie.
It's
my goblin voice. But it's what they sound like. And they like have this whole plot as to how they're going to kill her. Oh my gosh, you guys. It's still scary to this day. I mean, I've only was able to see clips because I can't find it anywhere. And it's kind of like a cult classic. So if anyone knows where I can watch the whole thing, please let me know. But I was able to watch the shower scene where they turn out the lights.
Watch.
But she doesn't know the lights are out yet because she's washing her hair and her eyes are closed. And they're in there and they're talking very quietly and they talk really fast. And so anyway, that would be the 1973 thriller, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
I would not be watching that alone.
No, you guys, let's write one. Let's write a made-for-TV movie. That would be fun.
It sounds like we can. It sounds like it's not something that's beyond us at all.
Anything goes.
When you hear some of the storylines that we're going to tell you, you'd be like, yeah, I think I can do that too.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by all of those hormonal changes Gen X women are going through? Just because those changes are from natural processes doesn't mean we have to suffer through them. And that's why Kristen, Michelle, and I love Hormone Harmony. It's a formula made only with herbal ingredients that are shown to reduce hormonal symptoms in women of all ages. The three of us have noticed improved sleep quality, gut health, and even our moods have improved. The science-backed herbal extracts in Hormone Harmony, called adaptogens, help the body adapt to all those hormonal changes that cause those life-disrupting symptoms, like hot flashes, and night sweats, bloating, and gas. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromises when it comes to quality, and it shows. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds, and there are over 30,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony, with one of the biggest benefits mentioned being, I feel like myself again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code PCPS at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code PCPS for 15% off today.
I was always a fan of the celebrity bio made for TV movie. A huge fan because I had a fascination with old Hollywood when I was a kid. And I had this book that had short little bios of all sorts of old film stars. What I came to find out later is that those short little bios were actually obituaries. I had a book full of obituaries.
I remember you telling us about that. Yeah.
I had no idea. I'm like, oh, these little biographies. I love them so much. So when the Jane Mansfield story aired on the CBS Wednesday Night Movie in 1980, I was all in because I already knew all about Jane Mansfield. If you don't know who Jane Mansfield is, she's sort of like a second banana to Marilyn Monroe. She was really trying to fill those shoes. And this is, IMDb describes the Jane Mansfield story like this. The gaudy rise and dizzy fall of the last great Hollywood blonde bombshell, starring Lonnie Anderson as Jane Mansfield and Arnold Schwarzenegger as her bodybuilder husband, Mickey Hargitay. And correct me if I'm wrong, isn't Mariska Hargitay from
That's
that show?
That's her mom.
It's her mom and dad. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lonnie Anderson are her parents. And there are oftentimes some very shocking aspects to TV movies. And the reason that this one is so memorable for me is because of how Jane Mansfield died. And the movie opens with her death, which is sitting in the backseat of a car with her children next to her. And it's nighttime and you see these headlines and you hear horns honking and then car crash. But what I know from reading my book of obituaries is that Jane Mansfield was decapitated.
Oh.
And so I know. And so I'm, as a 12-year-old, going, I know that this happened, and now I'm watching this on TV, and I'm trying to figure out the logistics of how she was decapitated. In, don't anyone send this to Mariska Hargitay.
Well, wait, was she one of the children sitting with her in the backseat?
I'm trying to find out, and I cannot. Well, she must have been, because her mother died. So that wouldn't be her mom if, oh, but she could have been at home. Okay, never mind.
Right, there could be, yeah, I don't know how many children, yes, Jane Mansfield had.
But I've been a little obsessed to find out if Mariska Hargitay was one of those children in the back seat. And I pray to God that she has had monumental amounts of therapy, because that scene has haunted me since 1980.
Well, yeah, if she was, she probably has, because she is married to my, like, number one hall pass, Peter Herman, and they have a wonderful family.
Oh, yeah.
And they have like 3 or 4 children. Some of them they've adopted, and they have a really.
So you're
great,
telling me she's okay.
She seems okay. Yeah.
Okay.
I can't say for certain. She seems okay, but you know what? So do I. So.
I know. Good point.
But I think based on the themes and subjects of the show she's in now, she'd almost have to have a therapist just to get through some of those plot lines.
Absolutely. Like, they should provide therapy for all of those.
Well, she's been on that show for like 49 years. So, yeah.
That's why I don't watch the show. Like, because I don't have a full-time therapist.
So no, I can't watch those types of shows. Yeah. Another one that is like that is, starts with the death, is the Karen Carpenter story from 1989. And if you all listened just recently to our Carpenter's episode part one, we talked about this. This one came up a lot because
I did.
We used it in our research, even though we weren't positive how accurate it was. We felt that Richard Carpenter produced it, so there had to have been some accuracies in it, if not most of
at least the details. He wants us to know.
The tagline for this in the advertisement was, "She had only just begun, and suddenly her world was falling apart." This also has the classic over-the-top made-for-TV movie opening sequence. Rainy Days and Mondays plays over the opening in when they find her body. What I've Got, they used to call the blues. Sometimes I'd Like to Quit. Nothing Ever
Seems. Never seems to fit. Hanging around. Nothing to do but frown. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down.
Gosh, that even sounds sad to me.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Hello, metaphor, right? And think about how many times she sang those words.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's in the hospital then. The ambulance comes and picks her up. The part that's heartbreaking is when Richard screeches into the driveway as the ambulance is pulling away, God, and he gets out of the car. Like, what's going on? What's going on? But once in the hospital, she seems to rise from the gurney, and she starts roller skating around the hospital. So there's almost as she's dying. Yeah, this is very melodramatic. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly she's a teenager, and it becomes a flashback to her childhood. And that's when the movie begins.
And Rainy Days and Mondays is playing the whole time.
Yeah. And it's very dramatic and over the top, but you know what? It works. I mean, it gets you in that kind of that mood of that real melancholy, and then the connecting the present day to the past, and it's the same person is basically what I'm seeing, right? Like,
well, and it makes me wonder if, just because we've talked about two movies that opened with the death of their person, they're dramatic. I wonder if that is a trope that they use for made for TV movies.
Good point. Good. That's a good question.
Start with the death. Mm-hmm. I mean, she walks, like, they find her body. That's the opening scene. Finding her dead body.
Yeah. You just hear the scream. Weird. You hear the scream of, I think it's her mom.
Yeah.
So you guys, we had lots of feedback on Instagram and Facebook about people's memories of TV movies. And a lot of people shared some fun stories, but there was one I felt that truly exemplified the importance these movies could play in your life. So this comes from Dina. Dina's our good friend on Instagram. She's at 30 Cats. She's a great supporter of the PCPS and engages with us a lot. She said that the movie Alex, the Life of a Child, kind of prompted her, not kind of, it actually prompted her to volunteer at a cystic fibrosis camp, which led to her meeting her husband.
Oh, wow.
Gosh, that's
so
cool. So
that one movie, she says, literally played a huge part in my life. So it's like all thanks to the movie, Alex, The Life of a Child, that led to, you know, her marriage.
And also, it sounds like that was another Disease of the Week movie.
It was. But I also would like to say it also did, besides that being good, Dina, we also would like to applaud you for volunteering.
Oh, that too.
For children with cystic fibrosis, because that was another good thing that came out of that movie for you. Yeah.
Forgot about that part. Okay, so let's go back to the concept of quality again. We mentioned that oftentimes these were low-budget productions with kind of B-movie status. Not all of them. I mean, some of them, like we said, are star-studded affairs with Emmy nominations and stuff like that. But in the case of made-for-TV movies, quality can take on a different meaning because it could be that it's the lack of quality that is exactly what makes it unforgettable. And when you read the descriptions of some of these movies, it reads like pure comedy.
Yeah, To me, I feel like the titles and the taglines in the advertisements of these made-for-TV movies are basically after-school specials p.m., like at night. And you guys, I was looking for these. I could have kept going forever.
It's like
for those
hobby.
Of you listening, just do a Google search for made-for-TV movie advertisements, like their TV ad, their TV guide ads, and you'll have like a solid hour of quality entertainment. So here are just some of my favorites that I found. In Love with the Son, Betrothed to the Father. This is the 1981 movie Child Bride of Short Creek, starring Diane Lane as the girl, a young 1981 Christopher Atkins, hot off Blue Lagoon, as the son. And you guys, the father that little young Diane Lane is betrothed to? Conrad Bain.
No,
Mr. Drummond.
Yeah. Wait. Diane Lane would have been like 13. She's marrying Mr. Drummond?
Right. Because it's Child Bride of Short Creek.
Oh, yes. Child Bride. I get it. I understand.
It says, the longer tagline says, for generations, their beliefs allowed the elders to take as many wives as they wanted until a young girl is promised to the father of the boy she loves. So, you know, you've got Diane Lane and Christopher Atkins. That's cute. But then you've got Mr. Drummond. He always creeped me out anyway. I'm just going to say. I don't know why.
It's a very monochromatic color palette he's got.
He had a turkey waddle, though. He had kind of that long neck.
He did.
What's wrong with a turkey waddle?
Okay, this is a good one, too. She's 40 and in love again. Stay with me now. He's 20 and her best friend's son and her son's best friend.
Suddenly, she felt alive again, and he was the reason.
So who is he?
There was only one problem.
He's young. What?
And his mother was her best friend.
Eddie. She is my age. Why can't I have the one thing that makes me happy?
That was a younger man. What price would she pay for love? The Anatomy of a Seduction.
Oh, oops.
Anatomy of Seduction.
I wanted to add in my little tagline, which I think I found from the thing you said, sent us, Kristen, but it said a 1979 romantic soaper about a frosty divorcee's affair with her bosom buddy's college age son, who is also her son's best friend.
Yes.
And I wanted to know, what is a frosty divorcee?
Yeah. What is that? I was trying, as you said, I was like, frosty?
I think like,
shouldn't it
like,
be like hot?
Kind of cougar. Like, yeah, it should be. Frosty sounds like she was cold.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it means like
more salty about something. Like
yes. Yeah. Anyway, frosty.
Frosty, I get a negative connotation from.
I do too.
Please tell us more about this.
One I liked about this is that Rita Moreno plays the best friend, but in the advertisement, the boy, it's kind of a drawing, but it's a drawing of the two actresses. The boy is sucking on her fingers of the divorcee.
Oh God! What? What?
Yep.
Shut up!
No, look it up. Okay. Here's another one. Althea is 40, separated, ready for a new life with a new man. Only one thing stands in her way, her teenage daughter.
Ew. Oh,
this
gosh,
one's called, it's called Like Mom, Like Me, starring Linda Lavin and Christy McNichol. I started watching this one on YouTube. 1978, Christy McNichol. We love her. We adore her. I actually want to finish this one. I just ran out of time. Like Mom, Like Me, because that's a good cast, Linda Lavin and Christy McNichol.
Yeah,
now, another Christy McNichol gem 2 years later, but this one is also starring James Vincent McNichol, which is what it says.
James Vincent.
Yes. He wanted to. This one's called Blinded by the Light, and it says, her brother disappeared in a world of brainwashers and blackmailers. It will take all her love to get to him and all her strength to get him out.
I think I saw that.
Oh, did you?
I think I saw
sure
that.
You
well,
did.
You've got the McNichols in it.
Star
How could you look
that's
away?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I would have watched that for sure.
Okay. I like this one. She put on a uniform and risked her life.
But when she took it off, she risked everything. Policewoman centerfold. Oh! You thought I just meant when she took off her uniform and put on like her regular clothes, right?
Right.
Nope. She put on a uniform and risked her life. But when she took it off, she risked everything. Policewoman centerfold, 1983. Okay. I like this one. Carolyn talked a little bit about Sweet Hostage, didn't you? Just talk about Sweet Hostage, mm-hmm. starring Linda Blair and Martin Sheen from 1975. Right. Just the little short tagline and the advertisement and the TV guides. When he captured a girl, he unleashed a woman.
Oh!
They're all nasty.
And then they're supposed to fall in love or something in the barn.
I know. Okay. I feel like this might be the best one from 1977. The tagline says, it's the title that's going to get you, but the tagline mm-hmm. says, to hide her sexuality, she must plead guilty to murder. And the title is, it's a real long one, so stay with me.
Okay.
In the Glitter Palace, where the gay people meet.
Wait, that sounds like something that would be in a hoochie house. Not something on the ABC Wednesday night movie.
Where the gay people meet. And then I just thought this was funny. There was one I saw called Glitz with Jimmy Smits and Marky Post. And the tagline just said, sleazy does it.
So when we asked our followers which TV movies they remembered, multiple people mentioned Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. I cannot believe I didn't see this. It's a 1978 TV movie starring the band Kiss and produced by Hanna-Barbera. Like, tell me, okay, now let me, just listen to this. Tell me if this sounds like an episode of Scooby-Doo. So the movie's plot revolves around Kiss, who use their superpowers to battle an evil inventor to save a California amusement park from destruction.
Is it an animated movie?
No, it's just a movie.
Gene Simmons is running around some amusement park trying to...
Yes,
it totally sounds like Scooby-Doo. And then there's someone chasing him and then he takes his mask off. Yeah. You know what? I'm shocked that they agreed to do that. And then because they were also on Love Boat, which seems very white bread for them to be mm-hmm. doing stuff like this. But again, maybe it's like we said before, that's just the visibility of we want to get our name out there. I don't know.
Well, and part of it is... seemed like a good idea at the time because the members of Kiss actually despised the film after the fact because it made them look so buffoonish. They looked like fools. They looked like fools.
They thought it was going to be some hard-hitting crime drama.
Yeah, like imagine running in those boots through the park, right? The glittery platform
boots, that's just not...
You're not going to look cool doing that. You're just not. And for years afterwards, they would... forbid anyone from mentioning the movie in their presence because they mm-hmm. were so mortified by it.
Okay.
That's funny, but it is true. One. Like, what did they think it was going to be? First of all, mm-hmm. two words, Hanna-Barbera, or is that one
Hello.
Word? Whatever.
Right? No, amusement park. There are a lot of red flags. Yeah. Right?
If it weren't for you meddling kids. You young whippersnappers.
Gosh.
Oh my God. So we actually have some society members who have a podcast of their own devoted entirely to reviewing movies from the golden era of TV movies, the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And it is called the Made for TV Movie Club. So we asked Beth and Kirsten, our knowledgeable podcast hosts, what their most memorable TV movies were. And here's what they said.
Hi, ladies. It's Beth.
And Kirsten
from the Made for TV Movie Club podcast.
So, Beth, we've been asked what is our favorite all-time made for TV movie. And I feel like there's sort of this before and after in my mind.
I agree.
So before we started doing the podcast, and now that we've started doing the podcast and had the chance to review these movies. So I would say from my memories that... my favorite movies were The House Without a Christmas Tree.
Correct.
And a movie we haven't done yet.
No.
But I do want to do.
I know, you know, I don't want to do
this. It's A Girl Called Sooner. Both of which are pretty darn depressing
and
dark.
They are, yes.
But you know that that's kind of where I like to live.
Yeah.
So now that we have gotten to review some more movies, the most enjoyable movie that I have seen so far is definitely Trilogy of Terror.
You like that one.
I love it, love it, love it.
I like that one too, but I will say, I think before we started the podcast, I liked In Broad Daylight, but we just reviewed The Burning Bed starring Farrah Fawcett, and I think... The writing is so tight. The acting is phenomenal. Every single actor in that movie, it's a great TV movie. And I'm going to say that that is probably my very, very favorite TV movie now after starting the podcast.
So The House Without a Christmas Tree is a movie we talked about in one of our very first episodes. Was it episode 2?
It is episode 2. Yep, I went back and double checked that.
And this is one of the many holiday made for TV movies, and it really is one of the best. It aired in 1972, and it stars Jason Robards as a grumpy man who hasn't had a Christmas tree since his Christmas loving wife died, much to the chagrin of his Laura Ingalls lookalike daughter, Addie. I seriously thought it was Half Pint the whole time. My mom for sure had this on VHS. Raise your hand if you recently moved your parents and you had to figure out what to do with all the VHS tapes and the VCR.
Well, there's another Christmas TV movie that came back on my radar. Do you guys remember The Gift of Love? This was Marie Osmond's.
Yes, this was
her acting debut with Timothy Bottoms, where they it's a retelling of the O. Henry story, Gift of the Magi.
And then they also mentioned Beth and Kirsten, The Burning Bed.
Yes. So if you guys remember that, that is a 1984 movie starring Farrah Fawcett, which in and of itself might say, okay, Farrah, let's see what it's about. You guys, this was about a woman who murdered her husband by burning him in his bed. That's the title. After she had been abused for more than 12 years. True story, you guys. This happened. It happened in Michigan. She not only set the bed on fire, the whole house on fire, and then went in and turned herself in, told the police what she did, and was found not guilty when she went to trial and acquitted for that crime. Now, many people doubted that Chris Monroe, I mean Farrah Fawcett, could pull off this incredible...
No, she's Jill. Chris is Sherlad.
Oh, yeah. Fuck. Okay. So,
good catch.
So many people doubted. Thank you. But you guys, she did. She was believable. And television critic Matt Seitz, in his 2016 book titled TV, The Book, praised her performance as one of the finest in the history of TV movies.
Wow, really?
And you think who that's up against? Yes.
No kidding.
But of TV movies, it's not a real, it's not a hard contest.
To win. As we go on.
She was phenomenal in that movie. I mean, think about it.
We're still talking about it, right?
Well, it's not just talking about it. I think The Burning Bed has become one of those kind of pop culture references, like when you say, oh, he's going to boil my, you know, oh, don't boil my bunny, or, you know, like
Fatal Attraction.
The Burning Bed is kind of one of those pop culture references that people are one of those things people refer to.
And not only that, but this author or this critic said that The Burning Bed, in his book, he says is the seventh greatest American TV movie of all time.
Wow.
He wrote that this film was a landmark in terms of content, depicting domestic violence as an unambiguous horror and a human rights violation.
Wow. And I think people watched it. I mean, this is brilliant casting, because people were watching it to see how Jill Monroe, aka Farrah Fawcett, how could this woman that we had just thought of as a jiggle actress was going to take on something so ugly and serious? And she nailed it.
Yeah.
Totally. And it even, didn't it help change laws about domestic abuse?
Oh, it did. And it helped change laws. It helped bring it again, much like Battered, when we talked to Karen Grassley, this issue that's often, you know, kept in the shadows, not talked about. It gave us a platform to talk about it and to get some laws changed and to really bring it to the forefront. So, yeah, it was a good one.
It's a good one for her legacy.
Yes, definitely.
Oh, absolutely.
Definitely.
She's got the poster, which, well, you know, is historic. Most still to this day, the biggest selling poster of all time. And then she has The Burning Bed. Those are good things.
Another one that Beth and Kirsten mention is Trilogy of Terror, which is from 1975. And this is one that was mentioned over and over by our followers, our society members on social media. This one clearly left a big impression. Now, here's the log line. Trilogy of Terror, starring Karen Black, in which Karen plays four tormented women in three short horror stories. The first, Julie, finds Black playing a murderous English professor. The second, and admittedly weakest of the bunch, has Black doubling up as mentally unhinged twin sisters. Of course, we got to have some twins in there somewhere.
Oh, you need twins.
Yeah. And Amelia, the final entry, pits Black against a homicidal and totally batshit Zuni fetish doll come to life inside her high-rise apartment.
I don't remember this at all. Movie. Do you guys?
No, I don't. Well,
I'm not a scary movie, horror movie type person.
I'm a scaredy cat.
Well, and you know, I think those, the TV movies, the horror movies, those were almost scarier to me because as you mentioned earlier, Kristen, there weren't the special effects. They didn't have the budget for that. They really had to play on that kind of, the fear factor and the what's behind the door, really happen. Like there could be little goblins in your wall. Like how would you know?
Don't turn off the lights in the shower. Don't do it. Yeah. Don't open that door.
They're
don't go in there. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There was, another one called, and now, like when Michael calls, do you remember this?
Oh, the name? Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. When the woman's son had died, but she's getting phone calls.
Is that the one that is coming from inside your house?
No, like that's a different one. I think
that's called When a Stranger Calls.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's coming from inside the house.
That creeps me out.
That's
Scarred.
Another scary one. But yeah, just something that the TV movies to me had a possibility of really happening. Mm-hmm. Lots of times the scary movies at the movie theater. That's never going to happen.
Like the goblins, ones, maybe not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. The goblins, maybe they could. I don't know. Because they were little just miniature humans, kind of, just with weird pointy noses.
Well, we don't remember. Maybe the three of us don't really remember Trilogy of Terror, but lots of people do because Trilogy of Terror has developed a cult following over the years and earned a reputation as a cult classic. And that Zuni doll from the third segment, that has been called by some as one of the scariest dolls in movie history.
Which means I'm
so
not
I guess
Googling
up against,
it.
Up I'm against, yeah, don't Google it. Right up now. Against those little gremlins in Carolyn's movie.
Right.
And also MeTV even deemed Trilogy of Terror the scariest television film of all time in 2016.
That's not
what they
watching.
Say.
I can't.
No. Zune. Oh, I think I saw this movie.
Oh my God.
Show us.
Okay.
And guys listening right now, we're going to post this and like, is it something we can post in stories this week or no?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Is it too scary? Will people
no,
run?
No, okay. But I, as
will
soon
people
as I
run
saw
and throw
it.
Their phone like in the lake?
As soon as I saw it, this might even be a scene from the movie. Oh my gosh. As soon as I saw it, I know the Zuni fetish doll.
Yes, I know that doll. Oh my God. Oh my God.
See, oh my God! Like I've seen that doll, like in
with
seen
the teeth.
It
recreate, it's the teeth.
Why do they call it fetish doll?
I don't know.
Zuni fetish doll, but yeah. As soon as I saw it, I saw Trilogy of Terror.
Mm-hmm. So it turns out that the movie of the week was chock full of terrifying and disturbing content. And one movie that people have been mentioning, I swear, even before we asked about this. As if they just needed to talk about it. Apropos of nothing, they're bringing this up in the comments on our social media feed, is Bad Ronald.
After an accidental murder, Ronald, a lonely and unpopular boy, takes refuge in a fantasy world, an existence that becomes inescapable and deadly. Starring Kim Hunter, Dabney Coleman, and Scott Jacoby in a compelling thriller, Bad Ronald.
I had never even heard about it until our followers brought it up.
Yes.
It's a 1974 movie. I probably wasn't allowed to watch this. A 1974 movie about a family that moves into a new house unaware that there's a secret room occupied by a psychopathic teenager who has just killed his bully. This is too scary for me now. And it's on TV. Yeah.
He's not a ghost. He's an actual...
A person
who's hiding out there because he's just killed somebody. Oh, that's frightening.
And we just bought this house and we're going to move in now.
Yeah,
oh,
no.
There's a guy
no,
here.
Thanks.
Yeah. Mm-mm.
Well, when I just put it into Google, it said people also search for Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. That's the little goblin movie.
Yeah.
And then I had forgotten about this one, but now I recognize the picture. The little girl who lived down the lane with Jodie Foster.
That sounds familiar.
Oh, my God. You just Husker-dude me.
They called her the little girl who lives down the lane. All alone in that big house. Who was she? And what was her secret?
Will you read the log line for that little girl who lived down the lane? Because I remember being afraid and I don't remember what it's about.
Yeah,
and it's Jodie Foster.
It's like a silhouette thing. I'll just tell you what the little... blurb says she was only a little girl. She lived in a great big house all alone. Where is her mother? Where is her father? Where are all the people who went to visit her?
Oh,
what is her unspeakable secret? everyone who knows is dead.
You're good
She's
at that,
She's a bad
Carolyn.
Seed.
Kind of, yeah, and there's like the thing that would have been in the TV guide.
Oh,
like
that's a good one. Wow. I'm going to share, totally you guys listening, that. I'm going to share this week either as an Instagram post or in story somewhere, maybe in the newsletter. I don't know yet. But these TV ads, because yeah, the pictures so are so funny. So okay, so but back job. To these terrifying. What is with, I mean, it's like the more freaky, terrifying, and just disturbing, the better. Listen to this log line. Kiss the girls and make them sigh. Hunt them down and watch them die.
On TV.
That's Deadly Lessons. Yeah. And guess who it's starring?
Oh my God, who?
Donna Reed and Larry Wilcox.
No, from Chips. Yeah. Not and Punch, but John.
And Donna
it's
Reed.
A Wonderful Life.
Donna Reed.
Donna Reed.
Yeah.
Did you know that the Pop Culture Preservation Society is on Patreon? Patreon allows you to support our work by becoming dues-paying members of our society. We are an independent, women-run endeavor with a commitment to delivering the highest quality listening experience to our community. And so we've taught ourselves how to record, edit, and produce a podcast in midlife, a time when most of us are asking our kids how to regram a TikTok, so that we can deliver episodes that truly speak to you. Support from PCPS patrons means that we can devote more of our time and resources to the content, sources, equipment, software, hosting, and research that you've come to depend on, without worrying about how to pay the bills. So thank you. We appreciate you from the bottom of our bell-bottomed hearts.
So many television movies released in the 1970s were also a source of controversy, in addition to being scary. There are some controversial topics that TV movies would tackle, such as Elizabeth Montgomery's portrayal of a rape victim in the drama A Case of Rape in 1974, or Linda Blair's 1974 film Born Innocent, or 1975's Sarah T., Portrait of a Teenage Alcoholic.
Yeah. Don't you think that those movies were important? Like, yeah. I think those movies, again, were ones that helped us talk about topics that were previously kind of, again, in the shadows, something mm-hmm. we weren't going to talk mm-hmm. about. This allowed it to be, one, maybe fictionalized, so you could talk about it at the water cooler the next day, or your parents could sit down next to you and talk to you about the dangers of becoming a teenage alcoholic. But you could talk about mm-hmm. Those things. I mean, you think about, we just talked about Battered and The Burning Bed and movies that portrayed eating disorders and child abuse. They were important topics, as cheesy as maybe, you know, the scenery was, or who was cast in some of these roles. It was really important stuff, I think.
And it was the impetus for a lot of them to get made. And speaking with Karen Grassley, why does she want, she didn't just want to star in Battered. She created Battered. She wrote mm-hmm. Battered, and she tried to get Battered produced in order to get people talking mm-hmm. about this topic of domestic abuse, because nobody seemed to think it was a real thing.
Right.
And that was her purpose in doing it. Okay, so one of our followers, when asked for her most memorable TV movie, said that one with Linda Blair, which cracked me up because I'm like, which one?
Right.
Because
right.
Linda Blair was one of the queens of made-for-TV movies. In the 70s, Linda, and remember who Linda Blair is, she starred as Reagan in The Exorcist, right? And was uh-huh. actually nominated for an Academy Award, wasn't she, for Best Actress? Or Best Supporting Actress? It was something crazy. Don't fact check us.
Here's a little bit about Born Innocent from 1974, which was mentioned above as controversial. So it says 20th century pint-sized icon Linda Blair paints a blazing on-screen portrait of a teenage reform school inmate. Super controversial for its depiction of female-on-female sexual abuse. And the lesbian feminist liberation dismissed the film stating, this cracks me up, stating men rape. Women don't, and regarded the film as propaganda against lesbians.
This is like, can you imagine this? In, what
shocking.
Was it, 1975?
Yeah, this 1975. No, and 74. I'm sorry. No, 74.
It's just crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't, I'm pretty sure that would not make it to TV today. That would never make it on TV.
It certainly wouldn't make it on network TV. I could see something on some of our other state, you know,
right.
Netflix or Hulu. But yeah, a lot of these topics, it's amazing that they didn't make it on TV.
So why all of this terror and controversy on made-for-TV movies? There's actually a reason. Networks could take risks with TV movies that they couldn't do with a TV series.
Because if it caused an uproar or if it tanked in the ratings, it was just a one-time hit to the network. Unlike a series, a TV series, where you could risk diminishing your audience and maybe even canceling the series. So this allowed them to do two things. They could go for broke and tempt big audiences with salacious content, or you could address controversial social issues that might risk a backlash from conservative audiences. Right? Because it's just the one time. Mm-hmm. You're just showing it the one time, get people talking, they get mad at you, but now we're moving on to something else.
Well, right. And not to mention, I think that even when you get the backlash from the conservative audiences, that makes all the more people maybe want to watch and see what's all this about that might not have even been aware of the movie before. So honestly, I think it's a win-win as long as they can get stuff past the FCC and all those rules and things like that. Which is really amazing that some of this stuff could get past some of those ridiculous, because I remember when we were doing the game shows and there were certain things in Match Game people couldn't say because they were too risque, certain phrases, you know, that we talked about. So
yeah, like you couldn't even say urine or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To say
and now you have bad Ronald
tinkle.
Yeah. Hiding in the bedroom, getting ready to rape somebody and then murder them. I mean, it's just bonkers. It's bonkers.
And in rewatching some of these over the past couple of weeks, especially the ones that are dealing with some really serious topics and issues, I've just felt that they weren't handled that well. I felt that they've just sort of been like, and put it out there like, oh, I know what's going to get people to watch. We're going to talk about, you know, incest. We're going to talk about abuse. Let's just make this movie. Let's put it out there. Let's get people talking. And when I watch it, I'm like, oh, ho, 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 like, you're showing one side, or you are showing, you know, you are not telling the whole story. So I feel like a lot of these from the 70s, yes, was it good that they're having people talk about a lot of these issues? Absolutely. That's always good for people, for these things to come to light. I feel like they weren't done in a way. Like, I have a lot of criticisms about them just because now I feel like I'm so conscious of making sure that everything is correct. Does that make
sense?
Well,
and there's a difference between salacious and raising awareness, right? And so you have to ask, what was their purpose in making this movie? Was it to make people go, oh my God, and then just they can't take their eyeballs off of it? Or is it to help people learn something? And oftentimes it wasn't to help people learn something. It was to make money.
Exactly. And just to almost make, like, it's almost, I feel like they put some of these issues out as movies just to like make a statement, like make people talk and make people be like, oh, almost like shock value, you know, like,
oh yes,
they're making a movie about that.
Yes.
You know,
eyeballs. It's all about eyeballs.
Yeah.
Let's get the eyeballs. And that, so there's in that vein, there is one made for TV movie that we will not be talking about today because I simply cannot. It feels so wrong. And I have no doubt that, you know, we talked about intentions. I have no doubt that the people involved with this movie had the very best of intentions. I really do. I think they did it with love in their hearts. But even by 1979 standards, I found it extremely uncomfortable. So bad. I just can't even.
Well, let's expand a little bit because some people might not know what you're talking about. And I think it would only be fair if we did, give it a little airtime because it's based on a true story and it's called Like Normal People. And if you might recall, it features in lead roles our first love, Sean Cassidy, along with Linda Pearl. And let's just say right there that the title has, there's an issue with title of the show. But based on this nonfiction book, it aired on ABC April 13th, 1979. Sean Cassidy and Linda Pearl portray Roger and Linda. They are a young couple, both with intellectual disabilities, who want to get married and have children and basically want to have the dreams, live the dreams that a lot of people want to live, but the law and others are saying they can't do it. So the movie, the New York Times actually reviewed the movie and said that these performances are not fudged. Roger and Virginia are portrayed with sometimes painful directness. Mr. Cassidy is admirable in suggesting and maintaining a sweet goofiness. Miss Pearl is uncompromising and thoroughly convincing in her slurred drawl nonsense determination. Right. So at the same time, I think, and going on what you were saying, Michelle, I've just, if we go back to that time and not with our lens of today,
right?
I know for me, of course, you better believe I was going to watch that movie if Sean Cassidy was in it. I still remember that movie. And it was probably, I'm sure, the first time that I ever thought, oh, these individuals who are different than I am have the same dreams that I have. Like they want to have these lives that all of us maybe want to have. And I don't think that I thought about people that had some challenges wanting the same things that I wanted. But it's a very natural,
I know, right? It's so hard to talk about. It's so hard.
Yeah, there were teachable moments in that, no question. Now we look at it, and I mean, just from the title alone, we're like, nope, that is not okay. But at the time, it wasn't something that was viewed as not okay. So it's not, it's that, and then it's just cut it for future Kristen. Just cut me after I say it's not okay.
To your point, Carolyn, that even though I was super uncomfortable watching this movie, their point was made in that I did for the first time go, well, yeah, I bet they want to get married. Why shouldn't they be able to get married? And look at all these people who are trying to stop them from getting married. And so that was an important thing that they did. And that was their intention of showing this. It's just that the standards with which we do those things today are a lot different. And number one is that we would never have cast neurotypical people to portray people with intellectual disabilities.
Exactly.
Now we have a standard and a guideline that we just didn't have back then. And so those portrayals that might have been masterful by Sean Cassidy and Linda Pearl, they just make me uncomfortable. I just keep coming back to uncomfortable. I'm just very uncomfortable. And so maybe it was my 10-year-old self going, I don't think you should do this.
Yeah. And I think there was another movie that I had forgotten about until I was doing my research for like normal people. And it was called No Other Love. Do either of you remember that?
I remember seeing it referenced, but I don't think I've seen it.
Okay, well, that, a very similar storyline, two, and I'm reading you the tag or the log line, as you said, two marginally intellectually disabled young adults fall in love and wish to marry. And this starred Richard Thomas and Julie Kavner.
Oh, my goodness. Brenda from Rhoda and John Boy.
John Boy. And I do remember that movie after when I went back and looked at it after I saw the reference to it. I do remember that as well. So, yeah, I think all of those things. I don't think anybody was trying to get away with anything when they were doing these, making these movies. I think it was important at the time. But, yes, we've learned and we know more and we do better now.
So that's a lot of movies we just talked about. A lot of movies in a seemingly random fashion.
And it's not very, even very all of random. Them.
Oh my God. And it's just like we needed to get all of those crazy, crazy plot lines out of our systems. But still, you're probably like, what about this one? And what about this one? I can't believe you didn't talk about this one. Don't worry. It's coming.
Yes, you guys. It is coming next week. So join us then for the countdown of the top 10 most memorable made-for-TV movies of our childhoods. And you guys, if you're screaming at your device right now because we forgot your favorite, chill out. That's probably because it's made it into our countdown.
Very exciting.
Oh, thank goodness, because I've been screaming for the past hour at my microphone. And thank you all so much for joining us today. If you're at all curious about those little goblin people in the shower or the Zuni fetish doll, please sign up for our weekly reader. That's our newsletter that's like an extension of our podcast, and we'll send you the links to the things we've talked about. And this week will probably be a doozy.
You've got to see the teeth on the Zuni fetish doll.
I know. I actually can't wait to find some of those things. The news, our weekly reader is free. It's fun. And you can easily sign up at the link in our bio in Instagram. You can just scroll down and you will see a link that says sign up for our fun PCPS emails. And we want to give a special, special thank you to our supporters on Patreon, because honestly, without the support of our patrons, this podcast could not keep on trucking.
And today we want to give a special shout out to patrons Sheila, Cheryl, Aaron, Sean, and Kathleen. Thank you all so, so much for your support.
In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of the cast of Three's Company. Two good times.
Two happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie. Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.
Spread a little love and it will keep moving on. Something always happens whenever we're together. We get a happy feeling when we're singing.